good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And this evening, our guest is John Quirk, who spent many years working in intelligence, is now retired, and has a corporation where they track down money that has been deposited in banks all throughout the world, but he has fascinating contacts both in South America and in the Near East and the Middle East, and is certainly one of our favorite guests, and a man who always can give us inside information about what's going on, and at least give us some grasp of where we seem to be heading. John Quirk, how are you tonight?
Thanks, Stan. Good to be with you, as always.
Well, tell us a little bit about your take on what's going on. We hear all sorts of stories about what's going on in the Middle East. Some people say that the administration is concentrating military power in the Near East and Middle East, hoping to destabilize the Iraqi government and simply replace them, some sort of a local coup. Other people say they're preparing for a military strike, either the United States or Israel. What is your take on this?
Well, I think we're really, as I've been talking about the last year when it comes to Iran, we're really in the final stages of a real serious prelude to war. And if you look at the incidents, I mean, there's a lot of elements here. There's the increase of religion and religion's influences on Iranian foreign policy, the expansion of the United States military in the Gulf, the Stennis carrier attack force arrived today in the Gulf, and then the recent comments today regarding what Iran is saying. Basically, they're saying two things. They're willing to negotiate, but only if the West and the United States also stops nuclear development. Tomorrow is a very crucial date because the Atomic Energy Commission, the International Atomic Energy Commission, issues a report about Iran. And the report, from my sources, tell me that the report is basically going to say that Iran has expanded enrichment activities instead of freezing them. So this is a 35, I think, to 40 member board that is in agreement with the West, with other countries besides the United States. And it's a very crucial report on Iran. It's not the point of no return for the Iranians, but the point of no return for the Iranians is coming very soon. And what I mean by that is that pretty soon everyone will know that the Iranians have enriched uranium and are very, very close to having at least one, maybe six atomic bombs. So there's lots of maneuvering going on. The United States has so many ships there, it's almost that we're looking for an accidental confrontation that would be a precursor, a prelude to war. It would boil over into war. Things are not going well for us in Iraq, as everyone knows, and that we're getting somewhat mixed signals from the Iranians. The chief Iranian nuclear negotiator, his name is Larijani, said a couple things in the last couple of days. They're willing to negotiate, but then he also warned the United States against opting for force. He said that, and then the president of Iran came out and said, we are always looking for ways and means to start negotiations, but...
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Pick the story up there, John.
Well, Ahmadinejad has basically said they're looking for ways and means to start negotiations, but at the same time, They have no intention, the Iranians have no intention of backing down and stopping the expanded enrichment activities unless the West also agrees to freeze their nuclear weapons programs, which is, you know, it's just ridiculous. The United States and other countries already have nuclear weapons, and basically the president of Iran is saying we're going to develop nuclear weapons anyway. So there's a cutoff. I would say it's about March the 10th when everyone will agree, the West, European Union, Atomic Energy Commission, they probably already will say something tomorrow, that the Iranians are very, very close to having a nuclear weapon.
Well, of course, the statements by President Ahmadinejad are really totally irrational. It's almost as if he's inviting a nuclear confrontation, or at least a military confrontation with the West. Who in their right mind would do something like that?
Well, you know, there's a couple factors here. There's the religious influence on their foreign policy. You know, it's a fundamentalist state, a terrorist state, and it has this doomsday sect in it that is predicting almost the end of the world. You know, and in Islam, as in Judaism and Christianity, there's certain beliefs concerning, you know, the struggle at the end of time. You know, you have the Antichrist, the theories of Armageddon. And for the Shiites, who run basically Iran, they believe that the long-awaited return of the Iman is going to be in the final victory of the forces of good over evil. They're good, and the West and Israel are evil. And what's interesting, when you look at the dates here, you got to not only religion, you got to study the dates. The president of Iran and his followers that control the nuclear enrichment process and the military believe that the date is August 22nd. And this corresponds to the 27th day of the month of Rajab. I think it's the year 1400 or 1427. And that this is what many Muslims commemorate the flight of the Prophet Muhammad on the winged horse, usually identified with Jerusalem, and then to heaven and back.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were simply talking about the fact that the president of Ahmadinejad is making totally ridiculous statements for a rational person, saying, well, we'll freeze our nuclear development if the West will freeze theirs. I mean, you're not in the position, really, to make demands like that when, you know, you're up against the mightiest nation in the world. Certainly, the United States spends more on its military than the next 20 nations in the world. You know, combined, Russia, China, Germany. I mean, we have the mightiest military. No one questions that. So why is Ahmadinejad doing what he's doing? And, of course, John raises the possibility that this sort of sect that they have over there, I think they call it the Hedgetua Society, really believes they're going to be able to create a worldwide crisis, and out of that crisis and the chaos that develops, why the Mahdi would return. And now, are they actually anticipating the Mahdi will return in August?
Yes, they think that this is the date for the apocalyptic ending of Israel. And if necessary, the world. They really believe in this. Now, the other reason, I mean, that's the religious base, some of the religious base. The more practical base is that they believe with their allies or close ties with Russia and China are going to go to bat for them, okay? The Russians and the Chinese have, objected to a lot of the harsh resolutions that the United States and the Security Council have recommended. So on the practical side, they believe they have Russia and China on their side. On the religious side, they believe they have the history of the Quran on their side. On our side, if you will, the Security Council of the UN is demanding an immediate stop, unconditional stop, to their enrichment plans. the International Atomic Energy Commission, watch what they issue in the next 2 days. And of course, the UN and the EU and the United States are basically closing ranks against Iran. So the crisis is increasing. Now, on dates, even though the Iranians, they picked this August 22nd date, my friends, and I have a lot of friends in the Israeli government and Mossad and in the foreign policy establishment, I talk to them constantly. They see a date as June 15th as the cutoff. The Americans, who usually drag things out on things like this, they're talking about June 1st as the probably cutoff that we'll be able to take military action. And what that basically means is, if you look at the deceptions that the Iranians are laying down, that somewhere, either Bushehr, which is a city on the Persian Gulf, they've developed, they think, enough, intelligence officials think they've developed enough plutonium for 30 bombs. And that they've also got, in a place way up north in the mountains, very difficult to target, in a place called Saghand, they have uranium mining operations, and they already think they have 5,000 to 10,000 tons of uranium reserves. So everyone basically knows the Iranians are not, as they say, trying to develop nuclear power for, you know, electricity. So I think the dates between now and June are the crucial dates for the West to take action against Iran.
Well, what about Israel? I mean, certainly Israel is threatening that they're going to do something, because Israel really cannot continue existing under the tension it is today, surrounded in the south by the Palestinians, the radical Hamas, and there in the north by Hezbollah, which is certainly is the dominant force in Lebanon, and then of course you have Syria there that really wants to take the Golan Heights back again. What do you see happening in that region?
Well, Israel has a number of problems and concerns, really, that it didn't have before. You have an Iran that is in the process of developing nuclear weapons, an Iran that has threatened several times to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. You have Iran that has funded Syria, who's completely retooled Hezbollah. Hezbollah has thousands of rockets now, and by all intelligence accounts, the Iranians have supplied Shabad 3, Shabad 2, and Shabad 1 missiles to Hezbollah, which can go anywhere from 205 miles to 840 miles, so they could certainly hit Tel Aviv and the rest of Israel. And then you have what has basically been a civil war between the Palestinians, Fatah, and Hamas. So, and then the other thing is Israel is, by all standards, appears to be wounded. They didn't get their three hostages back. The Hezbollah has Iranian military officers and intelligence officers on the ground advising them. The Syrians have been trying to overthrow democratic Lebanon to give a better position to Iran if we go to war. So Israel is fighting on several fronts. They're fighting on the front against Hamas, the front against Iran, the front against Hezbollah. They're fighting also a public relations problem within their own country, because many Israelis are very disappointed in President Olmert, Prime Minister Olmert's conduct of the war. So what's interesting is that the Israelis, when it comes to Iran and lobbying the U.S. to do things, have been very quiet. And that tells me that the decision has already been made between Israel and the United States to take action against Iran.
Well, now, what do you think the effect would be on the rest of the Muslim world if America were to launch an attack on Iran? I mean, some people feel that this might really fuel the fires of radical Islam and then threaten the stability of countries like Pakistan, Kuwait, Egypt, to Saudi Arabia. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think that's going to happen. I think that in addition to any lobbying that the Israelis would be doing for the United States to take action, the Saudis, Kuwaitis, Turks, Egyptian, even the Libyans, people in the Gulf, Bahrain, Jordan, they want the United States to do something about Iran. They do not want to see Iran, even though it's Muslim, and they're Muslim, the Iranians are really Persians, they're not Arabs. They do not want to see Iran with nuclear weapons or the regional powers. So I think the results would be more encouraging individual small jihadist groups, cells, terrorist cells, to operate against the West and the United States. Now, of course, the United States believes if we remove Iran from the chessboard, that it'll take a lot of pressure off the insurgency that the Iranians are supporting against Iran with the Shia. I don't know if it'd take that much pressure off, but I think it would cut off some of the supply lines. I think it would cut off some of the unity between the Shia forces in Iran and the Shia forces in Iraq. The danger, and this is what the Iranians are playing to, they want a wider war. They may attack the Kuwaiti, the Iraqi oil fields, the Saudi oil fields. The big disaster, the fear that the United States has, is that the Iranian army with tanks and large numbers of forces would cross over into Iraq and attack our troops, which are... We have a lot of troops north of Baghdad and in Baghdad. Iran is right on the border, and it could be an all-out war. It could be a very messy war that could stretch from southern Azerbaijan to Iraq, Iran, and it certainly would go down into Saudi Arabia. The Straits of Hormuz could be blocked, where I think it's two-thirds of all the world's oil comes through. So that's what the Iranians are hoping for. They're hoping for, if we do attack them, we think it's going to be a temporary attack with cruise and Tomahawk missiles. They would like to see the war expanded.
Well, of course, this would have quite an impact on, certainly on the economy here at home. And of course, you know, if you raise the price of oil, cut off the oil supplies going through the Straits of Hormuz, and actually raise the price of oil to $100 and $150 a barrel, think of the impact on the economy here. Think of the impact on the stock market, production, certainly on trucking, on the flight, you know, the airlines, the farming. This could be a disastrous effect. They could have a disastrous effect.
Yes, and some of the people that would probably benefit from it might be Russia and certainly Venezuela. Today, Chavez in Venezuela, and you have to look at the linkage there, he has passed 60 laws restricting various freedoms for the Venezuelan people. And he plans to pass another 100 laws, and I was reading some of them on the internet. It's just incredible. Restrictions on the use of cell phones, restrictions on travel, trying to force American passport holders of Venezuelan heritage to drop their passports and become Venezuelans again. Tremendous restrictions on Venezuelans trying to leave the country, trying to get visas. And as I wrote in an article about a month ago, I said the Iron Curtain is falling down in Venezuela. It's accelerating faster than I thought. And probably in the next few months, he will kick out most American businesses or nationalize them. And then I would think within 12 to 18 months, he'll even try to kick out the embassy or reduce it dramatically. And right now, the people in Venezuela are panicking. They're doing as much possible to get out of the country. The last of the professional people are trying to get to Spain, Brazil. New Zealand is taking them in. They're taking doctors in and professional people. The doctors, the lawyers, the professional people, the university professors are doing everything they can to try to get out of the country.
Now you're talking about Venezuela, and certainly we're not hearing about that here in the United States. We're hearing that, Chavez is doing a few things, but he is moving very rapidly, in my estimation, towards the dictatorship, and he seems to be working very closely with President Ahmadinejad. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's John Quirk, and we're talking about what's really going on, certainly in Venezuela. And, of course, it appears that there's a very close working relationship between Ahmadinejad and Chavez, and Ahmadinejad and Morales in Bolivia, and now, of course, with Ortega in Nicaragua and the new ruler there in Ecuador. So it seems like and here we have a gentleman, Ahmadinejad, who is, of course, a fundamentalist Muslim, working very closely with Marxist revolutionary governments. That's a strange situation.
Well, this is right, and as I reported earlier, probably even a year ago, the Iranians are at the nuclear facility. It's called IVIC, I-V-I-C, outside of Caracas. They have a biowarfare lab they're cooperating on. There's been all kinds of overt deals of the Iranians teaching the Venezuelans to make gunpowder and building trucks, and rumors that they're building another container port for a Iranian container company. There's many Iranians there. There have been rumors that Chavez has issued many members of Hezbollah and other Iranians and some Al-Qaeda Venezuelan passports. Our immigration, our homeland security, scrutinizes all flights from Venezuela now very thoroughly. Separate American passport holders and Venezuelan passport holders and conduct large interviews with them. And most of the connections between Venezuela are to Texas, South Florida, and California, and New York. And so the United States is concerned about Venezuela. And some of the ravings that Chavez has done, he's going to cut our oil off if we go to war with Iran. He's going to do everything he can to damage the United States economically, and so on and so forth. Whether he does that is another thing. But he is certainly instituting a police state, a Marxist police state in the country.
And that's really such a sad situation there, because this is really, Venezuela has been very prosperous and been very, very stable for a number of years. And now suddenly the people have elected Chavez to power, and apparently the elections were fairly, probably as honest as ours are. And the people, of course, have been promised all sorts of things, but my understanding is that they're beginning to get inflation there. They're beginning to have real problems.
Yes, there's some cracks in what he's doing, and here's what he's done. He really hasn't delivered much to the poor, and the poor are getting fed up, as the rest of the middle class, on the large amounts of money that Chavez is sending to Cuba, Panama, the labor unions, to leftist groups like Noriega, to other people. And he squandered a lot of money. He bought 300,000 AK-47s from Russia, $4 billion in arms, which is, my sources in the Venezuelan military basically tell me, is a bunch of junk. The Venezuelans aren't trained on a lot of the equipment. So he squandered the money. He's wasted the money. There's many infrastructure programs there, broken bridges, highways. Caracas looks okay, but the rest of the country is basically falling apart. And that could be his undoing. And after many years, and I've criticized...
I'm going to ask you to hold right there. Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with John Quirk. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John is talking about what's going on in Venezuela. And, of course, Hugo Chavez has come to power, why, he's been wasting all sorts of money. He's spent billions of dollars on weapons and arms and AK-47s and fighter planes, and he's been giving money away like a drunken soldier or a drunken sailor. And the problem is that he promised the common people he was going to begin to share the money with them, the vast wealth that Venezuela gets from their oil sales, and he hasn't really helped the common people very much. What he's doing, of course, is driving the middle class out, and so many of the professional people and the people who are productive citizens and the people who make the country work are beginning to flee, exactly as happened in Zimbabwe, it used to be Rhodesia, in Africa. And, of course, there's inflation now in Venezuela. Well, of course, if you get into Zimbabwe today, why, the inflation rate is 1,200% a year, 100% a month. Venezuela is just beginning to feel the ravages of inflation. But with inflation, you know, of course, the poor people have no protection against it, and they become even poorer. And then, of course, the infrastructure, the work that should be going into highways and bridges and other things, apparently none of this is getting done outside of Caracas, the capital. And so there are some real problems, Chavez. Would that be a fair statement?
It's a fair statement, and the other thing is that the nomenclature, the bureaucracy there, he's replaced with basically people from the ranchos, the chavistas, who have no training in managing water projects or garbage pickup or managing how to take care of bridges or ports. They're rewarded by being put in there because they support him politically. And they have no training. Many of them are uneducated. A lot of them are, in fact, illiterate. He has not basically replaced the diplomatic corps. He needs them for overseas. He's built up and paid off the army. All the senior generals in Venezuela have yachts and boats and multi-million-dollar mansions and big salaries. They keep him in power. But there's a lot of rumblings. And I must say, for the first time, and I've been critical of U.S. foreign policy with Venezuela, the U.S. is starting to do some very good things. They're ignoring him. They're looking for other sources of oil. The United States is doing attempts to isolate him. We're forming greater bonds with Lula in Brazil, who has kind of turned his back on Chavez. We're pumping up people in the Caribbean. Chavez made a tour of several countries last week and gave anti-American speeches, and nobody in these countries applauded him. They kind of turned their back on him. So they're starting to see the kind of demigod and crazy person he is. I mean, he's basically calling for the destruction of America. And even if you're in a country, any kind of even a left-wing country in Latin America, you would not call for the destruction of the United States, especially with all of our economic ties all through Latin America. So he is starting to isolate himself because of his madness. And the United States is playing it very cool. We're not aggressive. We're not trying to overthrow his government, which is democratically elected. But we're starting to isolate him and ignore him. And I think if it keeps up, I would give him another maybe 12 months to 18 months, and his own people close to him in the military or even in the political structure may try to remove him.
Now, do you think that there's any chance of a military coup replacing him? We had one some time back, and of course, after the military had replaced him, the United States didn't back the military, and Chavez was able to come back in power. Do you think we'll make that mistake again?
The United States has denied implication in the coup, but we were involved in the coup. The trouble is, and this is a problem we have in the intelligence community, we can't keep secrets anymore, and the efforts of Otto Reich, who was a great foreign policy advisor to the Bush administration on Latin America, his efforts in supporting some of the opposition in Venezuela were exposed by the media in this country. We can't keep secrets, and Chavez was warned, and he planned, he knew it was happening. The Cubans run all of Venezuela's counterintelligence. They work in the United States against us. The Venezuelans and the Cubans work against us in terms of espionage. The Cubans run his military, political campaigns. They protect him. His whole bodyguard force is Cuban, not Venezuelan. So the Cubans are in it for money and oil. They're riding the gravy train. They never had it so good. And the victims in the whole scenario are the Venezuelan people.
Isn't that always the way it is? Well, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment with John Quirk. And as we begin and analyze what's going on, and if you'd like to give us a call, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly our guest this evening, John Quirk, talking about really what's going on in the Middle East, and then tying it, of course, to what's going on in South America. And, of course, the significant thing is that President Ahmadinejad of Iran is over there visiting Hugo Chavez and signing all sorts of pacts with him, and then, of course, visiting Morales in Bolivia, Ortega in Nicaragua, and the newly elected Marxist president there in Ecuador. And so certainly Ahmadinejad seems to be looking for allies in our back door, you know, and in our backyard. And I would think that that would cause at least some people in Washington, D.C., an element of concern. Certainly, it's one thing when we're fighting an enemy in the Middle East. It would be another thing if we were fighting an enemy not only in the Middle East, but also, you know, in South America.
Yes, and a lot of the so-called trade agreements are just a sham. There's nothing that these countries can really benefit from. I mean, Venezuela gives oil to Bolivia, and Ecuador has oil, and Mexico has plenty of oil. So Iran is there to place agents, military advisors, and to set up terrorist cells so it can be the soft underbelly of the United States. That's what the Iranians are doing here. They're a terrorist country, and they are exporting terrorism to these countries and training these countries with the hope, Chavez's hope, that someday all these countries will reunite against the United States and possibly attack us. I mean, he says he wants to destroy imperialism, but he's building up his military, his navy, his air force. I mean, it's not going to do him any good, especially if he buys Russian equipment, which is mainly junk, or Chinese equipment. And the Chinese they want Latin America at this stage just for trade. They do have some military agreements, the Chinese, with the Caribbean and Latin American countries. And a lot of their equipment and technology that they're selling is very good, but they're very, very cautious about going easy against the United States. The Russians are not. The Russians want to try to block, thwart, and hurt us wherever they can, and, of course, to unload all their military junk that they have so much of. I mean, that's what the Russians produce that's good. They produce things that kill people, either weapons or biological weapons or nuclear weapons. And they're just doing it for revenue and to try to hurt the United States.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mr. John Quirk. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest this evening, John Quirk. And John, would you like to get your website up there in case people would like to get in touch with you? Now, John,
well, thank you. Yeah, our website is www.assetlocationinternational.com.
AssetLocationInternational.com. Do you post any of the articles that you write up on your webpage?
There's a couple. Yeah, I don't have all my national security articles, but if people email me, I'd be happy to send my articles on Iran, the Mideast, and what's happening in the world of espionage and certainly in Venezuela.
All right, now how would people email you?
My email is irgglobal@aol.com.
Right, and all you have to do then is put in irgglobal. Well, now, of course, if we were to, I hope and pray it doesn't occur, but if we were to get involved in a war with, certainly with Iran, I mean, we hear of these reports that we really tend to are going to try to knock out all of their military, in other words, their command headquarters, their naval bases, their army bases, things of that sort. What do you think that China and Russia would do under those circumstances? Certainly, China has a lot of contracts and agreements with Iran. China wants Iran's oil; it needs Iran's oil and natural gas, and they have plans to build pipelines there for China to develop some of the oil fields in Iran. What is going to be the attitude of Iran of China and of Russia towards aggressive military action coming to dominate a nation that has previously been very, very friendly with both Russia and China?
Well, the situation today is that Russia and China, who are both veto-holding council members, the Security Council, they have very close ties to Iran, like you say. They continue to oppose economic sanctions or weapons bans. A travel ban to Iran was dropped because Russia opposed it. But they're not going to be able to do much. I mean, an attack on Iran would be the following. We would probably focus on the five or six major facilities that are developing nuclear weapons. That would be it, probably the first week. And that would be it would be limited airstrikes, B-1, B-2, B-52s, from Missouri, Guam, Diego Garcia. Large amounts of Tomahawk and cruise missiles launched from ships and subs in the Gulf. And then we would really not try to destroy anything else. The Iranians, who have been practicing maneuvers, probably, they would have a choice. If they then try to attack the Saudi, Kuwaiti, and Iraqi oil fields, and they're already maneuvering in the Gulf against our ships now with submarines, and on those subs, the Russians have supplied them with missiles that can sink our carriers, and the Iranians have many of these, like, PT boats that have been, you know, traveling all over from the Straits of Hormuz all the way up to Kuwait. If they attacked us, if they retaliated against our ships, then in a matter of hours we would destroy their air force and their navy. Now, the danger is twofold after that. Missile attacks against Israel, and then large numbers of troop incursions. The Iranians could attack our troops in Iraq. That's the real danger. The subset of that is that the Iranians have already started giving some assistance to radical groups in Afghanistan. So they basically have partnerships with the warlords in western Afghanistan, where the United States has never been real strong. So they would... They might help against us in Afghanistan. They could attack our troops, which could be a disaster, in Iraq. And I don't think they'd get very far in trying to attack the Kuwaiti or Saudi oil fields. The Kuwaitis are on alert. They bought more weapons. The Saudis are on alert. We have the support of Turkey. You know, there's a lot of different scenarios. The United States may try to use the Kurdish army against the Iranians. I don't think we'd do that because we don't want to offend Turkey. So it would depend how much the poker game would go up.
Of course, if I was Iran and I was attacked by the United States, I would not retaliate at all. I would just hope that, you know, they would leave me alone after the U.S. had knocked out their nuclear research facilities and nuclear production facilities. But the question is, are we dealing with rational people? My concern is, you know, how much support does Ahmadinejad have? All we hear is what he says. How do you think that the average people there in the the hierarchy of Iran feel? Ahmadinejad is simply a public figure. But I question whether he has that much support. Certainly I don't think he has that much support among a lot of the Iranians. I think a lot of the Iranians, the last thing they want is a conflict with the United States.
That's correct. They don't. They don't like him. Many of the people in the government don't like him. The expatriate community, even though they support Iran, the Iranian expatriates don't like him. But I don't think you're going to see, you know, nothing unites a country like an outside aggressor. So if the United States does attack Iran, the people would probably come together. They're also controlled by a very tight secret police. I have people coming back from Iran all the time telling me that there's griping and grumbling and people are not arrested. They're pretty free to do what they want. It's not so much of a police state. Maybe people harass women about not wearing the veil, but it's actually easing up. There's a lot of grumbling. There's a lot of anger, but that doesn't mean there's a grassroots movement to overthrow him. So it could work against the United States. If we attack them, people might come together. The worst delivery system that we have to worry about is not their Air Force so much or their Navy, but it's their large army and the missile threat. They have thousands of short and medium range missiles that could hit Israel, southern Europe, and could target all of our ships in the Gulf. I mean, we've got many, many ships in the Gulf, destroyers, submarines, aircraft carriers. They know where our B-52 and B-2 bases are, our B-1 bases are. So they could launch massive attacks against us. The United States is starting to reinforce our troops there with large numbers of Cheyenne and Apache helicopters, which, you know, these are pieces of equipment that basically destroyed the Iraqi army in 20 days. So, but we are exposed. Our troops are on the ground are exposed to a massive Iranian military strike, which would be they could attack our troops in virtually hours.
Well, one of the things that disturbs me is I don't think the American people want a war any more than the Iranian people want a war. And I think that certainly President Bush has lost a great deal of support of the American people, and an awful lot of people just want to get out of Iraq and end it. And yet President Bush seems to be intent upon, rather than pulling back out of the Middle East and the mistakes that we've made so far in getting in there, he seems to be intent upon, you know, expanding the war. Could he possibly get away with that? I mean, I would think there'd be a tremendous outcry from the American people and from even many, many members of both the Republican and the Democratic Party should he try this sort of a shenanigan.
Well, it's an excellent point, but I think a couple things. I think President Bush has already made up his mind to go to war with Iran. I think that the Israelis have put a lot of pressure on him. Saudis have put pressure, the Egyptians, and the Jordanians have put pressure on him. The Europeans probably have lost their will. They're kind of in the background. The UN is pretty irrelevant. They've just issued sanctions. They hardly condemn Iran. They condemned them 4 months later about having a Holocaust thing. The Democrats have said, Senator Reid and Mrs. Clinton have said they're going to do everything to stop President Bush from going to war with Iran. So what to look for between February and June is some type of provocation. The head of our forces in the Gulf, Vice Admiral Walsh, said in an interview in Bahrain, I think the other day, he said that there are possible accidental confrontations that could boil over into a war between Iranian and American naval forces. Now, that could be the pretext to war, almost like the Gulf of Tonkin, okay? Now, the Bush people are also trying to make an argument that the Iranians are supplying pieces of equipment on these IEDs that are killing our troops. They're trying to make a greater argument that Iran is supporting the Shia militias in Iraq. The U.S. is starting to move against Iranians in the country. And so the tensions are building up almost just like before World War One, if you will. So I think between now and June will be the answer. If we can get through June and August, and serious negotiations start, and it's only going to be if the Iranians back down, there'll be no war. If the Iranians don't back down, I would say even by March the 10th, it's a fait accompli that there'll be war. And I don't see how Congress can stop the president. I think that if something happens, if we are attacked, even the most outspoken critics of President Bush will close ranks to protect our troops that are on the ground there.
Well, that's, of course, the disadvantage of having your troops on the ground there. You can always say, you know, we don't want to go to war, but we're going to have to, of course, strike back at those who endanger our troops. one of the things that really puzzles me, certainly we feign this belief in the rule of international law. We go to the United Nations, all the time for permission to do that, and we try to get a resolution for this, that, or the other thing. But if it really came to going to war with Iran, don't you think that that both Russia and China would veto any sort of a UN resolution? Would we act independent of the United Nations and simply say we refuse to abide by international law?
Well, I think it's another good question. I think when you're talking about Russia, you're really dealing with the criminal mentality, and they really are the prostitutes of the international community. They want things from the United States. President Bush permitted them to come into the International Monetary Fund back in December. There had to be a quid pro quo that the United States got. Maybe it's to go against Iran. The Russians would really benefit in a way of an attack against Iran. They'd have a greater control over European oil and oil prices. They would resupply Iran. They'd go back and sell them billions of dollars of weapons. I think the Chinese are a little afraid at this stage of their relationship with the United States of being cut off from our purchasing power to Iran. They do get oil from Iran, but they have more. They're getting oil now from Venezuela, and they're building pipelines all the way to Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, so they really wouldn't be that hurt. The United States, diplomatically, some months ago, went to China and Japan and said, look, if there is a war with Iran, we will continue to keep the sea lanes open and make sure that you do get oil. We don't want you cut off from oil, because if we cut China off from oil, we're only going to hurt ourselves. I mean, the Chinese and Americans are kind of locked in with each other. The Chinese own so much of our paper, and we buy so much of their products. So I don't think China would kick up that much of a fuss. The Russians will be tougher to negotiate. They'll want all kinds of, they're good at extorting Europe and us. They'll want all kinds of agreements, and we'll probably make it to them, so they'll stay in the background. And then Europe may or may not support the United States. It depends. And again, the Bush administration does have egg on its face on Iraq, so again, the question of intelligence comes up. Do we have firm intelligence on how far along they are in developing a nuclear weapon? And that's probably going to be the biggest problem for the Bush administration.
I think we should remember what happened when America went to war with Korea back in 1950. And, of course, what happened is, when the vote came up at the United Nations, of course, the Russians wanted us to get in there. They were quite willing to fight to the last American soldier. They just walked out of the meeting, and then, of course, the other members of the Security Council voted to go to war.
There's more evidence that the Korean War was a Soviet covert action, that the Russians and Stalin pushed for that war. There's more and more evidence coming out that they backed the Korean War.
I don't think there's any question of that, and that's how they got us in. They just walked out of the United Nations, supposedly in a huff, to draw us in. And it could very well be that we're going to be seeing this happen all over again. I'm sure the Russians and the Chinese would love to see us fight to the last American soldier in the Middle East. Well, let's go to David, who's calling. He's from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. He's been waiting patiently. David, did you have a question for our guest?
As usual, thank you very much. It goes to your exact point, Dr. Stan, and considering that the gentleman's observations are as good and as true as what Toynbee's history would indicate, how much, and I had a follow-on, how much of our policy is being set and Mr. Bush is being advised via a organization, Mossad influenced via the State Department.
All right, by the question, I think basically, how much of what's going on today is related to Jewish influence or to Zionist influence in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's a good question, and you know, for many years, people have come up with the theory that the Israelis have hijacked our foreign policy. I think the decision has already been made, because you don't see much about the Israelis and their various lobbying groups here, AIPAC, which I happen to support, and a lot of other groups. You don't see them really lobbying the United States to take military action, and they know Iran is close to developing nuclear weapons, and that tells me the decision has already been made. I think it's a very important influence on our foreign policy. But I'll tell you what the conundrum is here. Bush has been the biggest supporter of Israel more than any other U.S. president in the last, since Israel's been founded. Yet American Jews do not support Bush. It goes back to Roosevelt, and it goes back to liberal ideas.
Hold that thought, please.
I had a follow-on. Is that possible?
We're out of time, David, but thanks so very much.
God bless you. Thank you so very much.
Okay.
Can I call you tomorrow?
Sure you can.
Bless you, sir.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, of course, I guess this evening has been John Quirk, and we've been talking about what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in the Near East, and certainly what's going on in Central America. I believe America is certainly at the crossroads. I think that there are going to be serious consequences no matter what happens here in the next few months. But, John, you feel that, of course, that certainly the 1st of June is sort of a target date, and then you talk about the fact that the members of the radical groups there in Iran are talking about August, the time in August when they anticipate the Mahdi will return. These are rather all ominous ideas, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and I'm basically an optimist. I've been constantly hoping for the last year that the Iranians are willing to really seriously negotiate, work out some kind of deal, whether we put tougher sanctions or we pay them billions of dollars to give up their nuclear program. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen, and I think we're on a course of what could be probably the biggest crisis that the United States has faced since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, would you call it a collision course with a disaster?
I think it's a collision course between civilizations. It's a collision course between religions. It's a course between economic resources, ideology, religion, and it doesn't seem like there's much diplomacy happening, much negotiations happening, and I think the consequences, I may be exaggerating it, but the consequences will be felt all over the world if there is a major war in that part of the world.
No, I don't think you're exaggerating it at all. I think that we're in for some very, very difficult times. And it's an exciting, dangerous, frightening time. And of course, from the Christian point of view, why, at least I have some hope and solace that somehow or other this is going to play into God's plan. Anyway, our guest has been John Quirk. John, thank you so very much for being with us, and we'll look forward to having you on one of our other programs next week.
My pleasure. Good night. Thanks so much, and God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview with John Quirk. I always enjoy getting John's views, because he has connections at the highest levels, certainly of many governments. And I certainly pay a great deal of attention to his suggestions and his overview. I hope you've enjoyed it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We try to bring you top-notch people in all fields, whether it be health or finance or geopolitics, and I think this discussion this evening gave you an excellent overview. And of course, during the time we were off the air, for some of you, John agreed with me that we're in a collision course with disasters. Something big is in the offering, and it could have disastrous consequences. So anyway, if you are out there and the listening audience, and you agree with me that behind so much of what's going on are powerful spiritual forces that are really directing the course of affairs. We hope that many of you will decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And for, well, you can just simply call Mary at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask Mary about joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters or subscribing to our newsletter. You can go up on my webpage at radioliberty.com and pull down all of our newsletters. We invite you to do that. Pull them down, put them in a binder, read them through. If you doubt any of the facts that we've listed there, you'll find things there that you will never find in any other newsletter. Why, of course, we'd be glad to provide the documentation for you. We try to have at least documentation for everything we talk about in those newsletters. So, believe me, I anguish over them, but I think that they're being read by leaders in this country and throughout the world. So, of course, we hope you'll read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which gets into the spiritual forces that are at work. If you have not yet, my pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. The occult hierarchy, there are three pamphlets based upon letters. Each one's about five newsletters, so each one's about 40 or 50 pages. They are available from Radio Liberty. You need to get our new book we're carrying on satanic crimes. You need to get The Diary of a Devil Hunter, which is an excellent book. Our four-tape set on Satanism and deliverance. Our four-tape set on the supernatural. And, of course, you really would want to read that along with the book that was written by Johanna Michelson, who's one of the people we interview in the four-tape set on the supernatural. And the book is called The Beautiful Side of Evil. That's The Beautiful Side of Evil. We certainly recommend the DVDs we carry. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version, and they're available in both DVD and in VHS. That's they sold their souls for rock and roll. And these people were in touch with the other dimension. You cannot make any sense out of the insanity of everything and anything that's going on today unless you understand there is another dimension and there are people who are in touch with that other dimension. And those forces have infiltrated the church. Those of you who haven't heard our interviews this last week with Carol Matriciana should certainly get them, as she talks about the influence of yoga in the churches today. And, of course, the yoga and the serpent, of the Kundalini serpent, which, of course, is the Hindu deity, which is such... plays an important part of what's going on today. So remember our number, it's 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, our webpage, radioliberty.com, and then of course we invite you to listen to our internet programs. They're live 5 hours a day, and you can certainly get those programs on radioliberty.com, where they're archived and they're in MP3 form if you can't listen to them live. And then, of course, you can get the programs on the other networks we're on. You can listen to us on shortwave. You can listen to us on satellite. We're on Telstar 5, and then, of course, on shortwave 4 hours a day. Please encourage others to listen to our programs. Understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that has determined what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And our next guest is a newcomer to Radio Liberty. Her name is Denise Nichols, and she works with Major Doug Rocky on the depleted uranium situation and the Gulf War syndrome that has actually incapacitated so many of the young men who went off to fight for freedom in the time of the first Gulf War, and within a few months of their returning home were ill, and more have become ill. Over 80,000 of the young men who went off to fight in that war are not no longer living. Now, most people say that couldn't be true. I mean, if that had happened, I mean, these are young, healthy men. Why would they die? If that had happened, why, we would hear about it. Certainly, Rush Limbaugh would have told us, or Brian Williams, or Sean Hannity, or. But, of course, you're not going to hear about this in the media. You can't understand that we are killing our own fighting men. But then, why should you be surprised? Henry Kissinger referred to them in the book. It's entitled The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein. Henry Kissinger refers to our fighting men as stupid, dumb animals. That's the way that the president's close friend, Henry Kissinger, feels about our fighting men. In fact, if you would read Woodward's latest book, Under Siege, he will tell you that the closest advisor to the President of the United States is none other than Henry Kissinger, who's really been directing the course of the disastrous war in the Middle East, just as he directed the course of the disastrous war in Vietnam, almost a third of a century ago, another no-win war. But if you'd like to get the documentation for that 80,000 deaths, you can just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you the figures from the Veterans Administration, just a couple of pages from their document, where they tell you that 695,000 men went over there, and at the present time, about 690,000 take 80,000 away from 695,000, that's the figure that they're still presumed to be living. In other words, if they're no longer presumed to be living, we have to assume that they're dead, don't we? And those are the Gulf Veterans Administration figures, but we can't tell the American people that. We can't tell them the true cause of autism. We can't tell them about the suppressed treatments for cancer. We can't tell them, why the rates of heart disease and diabetes are skyrocketing. We can't tell the American people the truth about most things because they couldn't stand the truth. Well, with us is Denise Nichols, who really is dedicating herself to trying to get the word out. Denise, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Oh, you're welcome.
Why don't you sort of tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and about your involvement? You were actually a nurse in the military.
Yes, sir. I served in theater during the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, and ended up on the border of Saudi Iraq, taking care of aeromedical evacuation, which were troops that went into Iraq on, the hook movement. Those troops, both the Iraqis and Americans. We had an Iraqi enemy prisoner of war that we also cared for.
But of course, you weren't really on the front lines. You were just sort of in the back there, but...
Well, there's no front lines in any of these wars anymore.
No.
And the Saudi-Iraq border was there. We were the first receiving for the air evac from the Army.
Hold that. We'll be right back in just a moment. All All right, well, Denise, certainly you were there on the Iraqi Saudi border. And so, basically, when did you begin to get ill?
Some of the symptoms I, you know, kind of ignored, but they were there in theater, and we just didn't pay attention to them. We had our duty to do, and we were doing it, despite having weird things happening to us. You know, when you are at war and you have a job to do, you don't think about yourself that much. You think about your buddies, you think about the job you have to do, and you keep it going.
Well, now, what about, did you get multiple vaccines at one time, or did you receive all the vaccines that so many of the people did?
Yes, I did. In fact, we had quite a few before we deployed, and when we got into theater, we ended up getting the anthrax vaccine. When we came in through Riyadh, before we moved up forward to King Khalil Military City and before we moved up to the border. So I did get the vaccines, all of them.
Did they give them to all sort of at one time, or did they stretch them out over a period of several weeks?
It was not stretched out. There was a lot of gang loading on the immunizations, especially for the Reserve and National Guard. I didn't get as many because I knew that we were probably going. I was just waiting for the call. So I took the effort to try to space my shots out by getting them before I got called out. That was a very, you know, smart thing for me to do, and so I did it. And I don't know how many others tried to think ahead and realize that, but the rest of them got additional shots that I'd already taken care of in the lead-up and waiting for our call to duty.
But my understanding is that many of them got, you know, four or five or six different shots, you know, within a period of 24 to 48 hours. Did you see that sort of thing going on?
Oh, I did. No doubt about it. There was the vaccines that were happening, like you said, gang-loaded. The anthrax vaccine being the one that we look at the closest for the problems of the adjuvants in it. And we continue to watch that problem. We've had the anthrax program stopped, and now they have started it again. We had a lawsuit that blocked them from giving the mandatory shots. But the mechanism on legal standing on that has changed, so they are going back and starting the mandatory shots again.
But of course, so many of our troops really got ill after the anthrax shots. And what about this? You mentioned the squalene. Were you aware that they were using experimental vaccines on our troops?
Not at all. A lot of this came at us in a hurry as we were getting called up.
Hold up. We'll be right back here.
You know, we had no
hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Denise Nichols. We were talking about the vaccines that she and the other reservists military were to take. But Denise, actually being a nurse, actually recognized, of course, she was going to have to take the vaccine, so she got some of them ahead of time so she could space them out. But when, of course, they give you, you know, six or eight different or ten different vaccines in a period of a day or so, you are getting a tremendous amount of aluminum. You're getting tremendous amounts of, some instances, mercury. And not only that, but apparently there were some of the vaccines which were experimental. They've never admitted this, but if you've never heard our four tapes set on vaccine A, why, it's a devastating tape set, and I think we have two copies of the book available. When those are gone, they're gone. The publisher is not going to republish the book. So if you're interested in vaccine A, which is the story of the experimental vaccine they gave to our troops, it's crippled so many of them, and of course, because it contains an experimental adjuvant called squalene. Why, this is available. Have you looked into that aspect of it, Denise?
Oh, definitely. I've looked into each exposure item. The squalene also, you might, if anybody's looking it up on PubMed on the internet, you can plug in MF59, which gets you close to squalene, but you can also put in squalene and get quite a lot of information on it, just by going to our hard source of research on the internet, which is PubMed, which is the NIH library system. But the shots were one factor. The other factor that came up to us and had not been briefed or trained on was the protostigmine bromide that we were ordered to take as protective measure against nerve agents. As we researched that, we found problems with protostigmine bromide. And one of the problems is, number one, it was developed, for other conditions, myasthenia gravis, in the normal civilian world, it's a licensed drug for that. What they were doing is an unlicensed use, which they wavered. The military wavered that, had it wavered, so that they could have the troops take it. And one of the problems with this is that, number one, it's effective against the nerve agent Soman, S-O-M-A-N, but not sarin. Now, Saddam never did have Soman, okay? He had sarin. So it wasn't even, our intelligence should have been able to show us which agents he had. So they were giving it for something that we weren't even going to encounter. And then when you have PB in a heat environment and a stress environment in the desert, we're still doing research on PB itself. Then the next causative agent that we would have had was the pesticides that were used in theater, which they normally use in theater, but this problem reverted that a lot of this was bought off the Saudi facilities, written in Arabic. We don't know what the percentage is and if they mixed it appropriately. We also had...
For our listeners, could I just mention that this is a pesticide. They actually sprayed it onto the uniforms to keep down what ticks and lice and things like that?
Well, pesticides they used to spray the areas, but they also used, we had the old stuff of the DEET from past wars. And then we had people that were trying to get the word out for the new troops. Please don't use those flea collars. They have pesticides in them, too. Then we had permethium, which is like a type of pesticide, that the uniforms were impregnated with during the manufacturing of it. All these things on pesticides, they use these things to try to control insects and endemic diseases for our troops. So it's a method of trying to control, but it has its hazards, just like we know in civilian life that it has its hazards. And certainly having permethium impregnated in the uniforms and you're sweating and have the uniform next to you, not a really good situation there. And I'll remind people that pesticides are organophosphate, just like the nerve agents are. It's just a little bit different. Depending on what agent you're looking at and what pesticide. So it all comes a class of organophosphate. So then we had that. We had the sand, which is a fact of life over there. And if you watched the invasion during 2003 in Iraq, you saw David Blum with his Blum mobile sucking down the sand and sand covered. The sand over there has a very high silica content. And if you look up silica and then you carry it on to mining and occupational health, you look up silicosis and you've got health problems there. So another factor that hit also the immune system. And then we have the exposures of the nerve agents themselves that started during the air bombing during the Desert Storm. We were taking out the chemical facilities during the prolonged air war before the ground war ever started. Sarin does not burn up. If you go to the technical specifications, it doesn't burn up. We had a small weather front, and so the sarin vapor itself came down range where all the troops were massing. This is work that was done by Senator Riegel's staff back in 1994. Then we had further exposures during the ground war and after the ground war, in fact, right before the ceasefire, when we have bunker complexes. Now, these are not just one bunker. These are huge complexes. The Kamacia bunker complex that was destroyed by the Army engineers was a quarter to half of the size of Washington, D.C. These were huge complexes where they went in, took C4, wired it, destroyed it. Again,
basically,
taking an ice pick to an ice cube, and it just scatters. We had more exposures that occurred from Kamacia, and that was an evolving story when we exposed that. We had videotapes from the troops that got that episode out to the public, and, you know, that truth came out.
But basically, Denise, that was because we actually blew up these bunkers, these massive bunkers that were crammed full of chemical weapons. And, of course, when you blow up a chemical weapon, why are you going to contaminate the environment?
That's correct.
Why would anybody in their right mind blow up these massive storehouses full of chemical weapons and put them in the environment? Why not just bury them and leave them there? And
They missed checking the fact of the specifications of sarin. They thought it would burn up. They missed it. They made a big error, a huge error of not checking the specifications on what was stored there. That was a huge error. We call it the largest friendly fire incident, being the sarin and bombing, the air bombing, and then exploding these bunkers. What people have to realize, we've gotten Kamacia truth out, but there was 150 other complexes, at least, that were destroyed. We have no videotape, so, you know, it's very hard to get the truth out when you don't have some kind of evidence to hang over their head. So the nerve agents were there. Whether we had any exposures from Scud, you could argue that, but, you know, just by our own actions, we had the sarin exposures. Then you move into other areas like the depleted uranium. But before we get to that, let's go back. There are endemic diseases over there. Leishmaniasis being one, which is the sandfly fever. We do not have an adequate screening test to this day. These are some of the lessons learned that I want people to hold on to. Number one, we're still using Promethean on the uniforms. You know, it's got to be looked at. It's got to be looked at as a lesson learned, and we've got to reevaluate these things and see if we're doing things right for our troops. Number two is the sarin, a lesson learned. Number three would be, you know, sand and providing protection against the sand. We had gas masks. We had no masks, and we're not. I mean, that wasn't even talked about. Another lesson learned. Another one, leishmaniasis. We have no massive screening test to really rule that in or rule that out. So we had at least, I think, 36 to 60 troops that we know had leishmaniasis. We've had more problems with it in this current Operation Iraqi Freedom. So this is a parasite that can remain dormant in the body and create all kinds of havoc. It can remain dormant a number of years and then come out and create havoc. There are ways to treat it. Walter Reed has a treatment program that they've been utilizing. It's pretty high-powered medicine that can be treated and pretty well batted down and controlled. Then we come to depleted uranium. And we come to the point that depleted uraniums were used in the weaponry, the HM use of it during the Gulf War. Not only that, but the use from the ground troops in their weaponry. And when it vaporizes, it gets into a very small sand-sized particle. We had Dr. Leonard Keith that even talked about it, you know, on the run-up to the war, of his concern about medical people ending up with dealing with people from forward, you know, in the battlefield area, be it our own injured or enemy soldiers, and having it on their uniforms and becoming exposed and having it inhaled that way, to the troops that were closer that got shrapnel, that got direct and DU inhalation. And then we had the terrific sandstorms. And no one's proven to us beyond a shadow of a doubt that the DU could not travel by being blown through these sandstorms that ripped down tents during Operation Desert Storm. The sandstorms over there are like small hurricane force winds.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Denise Nicholas talking about the first Gulf War and why so many of our people are ill today. Well, Denise, pick the story up there.
Okay, the depleted uranium is a hazard, and it lasts for 4.5 billion years, I believe, is the figure. I'm speaking off the top of my head tonight. So it's an area of contamination that we have left not only in Iraq, but now in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Somalia, ever since the first Gulf War. And I think we've researched it back to there might have been some first use over in Israel even before the Gulf War. Operation Desert Storm, we have one troop that has some interesting data on that. So this is a waste product of the nuclear industry that they give away, and we use it in weaponry because it works so well tactically, but it is a health hazard. Very similar to the situation with Agent Orange that defoliated the forest in Vietnam, the jungles rather, and was very effective in cutting down snipers and guerrilla attacks, you know, because you could see better if you used Agent Orange. But the thing is, it remains in the environment. It contaminates the environment. In fact, there is just no... Now we're making agreements with Vietnam to give them so much money to clean up Agent Orange contaminated areas, even now in 2007, after we left Vietnam back in 1974-5.
1974. But, of course, the thing is that the government's been insisting that there is nothing wrong with Agent Orange. There's nothing wrong with it.
The same way with Agent Orange, they assisted the same way with the atomic veterans. This is a repeating story.
In other words, they lied. They lied about Agent Orange. They're lying about depleted uranium today.
Yep. I believe they have. And the thing is that when you see documents where they talk about DU and they talk about if the consequences of DU became known, it would be politically unacceptable. I mean, there's terminology in these documents that you just, it jumps out at some of us, and some of us you have to reread it a couple of times to catch it, but it just takes your breath away when you put the whole picture together. And since I came home and I tried to pick up my life, go back to nursing and teaching nursing, I knew things were wrong with me, but I denied them. You know, it's a typical response, especially for troops. You deny those problems, and you keep chugging ahead, whether you're in war or, you know, going back to your life and trying to pick it up. But slowly but surely, you know, I started going, this isn't right. This isn't just lack of rest. It's not poor diet. You know, something's going on with my body. I started communicating with others quietly. I was watching the internet, and I agreed to, you know, take phone calls. And I would talk to troops that really had not been on the internet, maybe made one phone call to a connecting person, directed to call me. And, you know, as having been a nurse and knowing how to collect a good history, having been there myself, very well could, you know, take that history over the phone, and then I could talk to them about their symptoms. And going in an organized manner from head to toe, looking at each organ system. And it was amazing to me early on that, you know, all the symptoms were sounding alike. It seemed to be a pattern. In my research, I found that, you know, a lot of this, you cannot separate the symptoms of chemical from DU. They're overlapping in themselves. And the results are somewhat similar also.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Denise Nicholas here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Denise is talking about her return home after being in the Gulf, first Gulf War, and then, of course, having a chronic illness, and then she gets talking to a lot of the other veterans who have exactly the same symptoms. The problem is that they go to the Walter Reed Hospital or the VA VA hospitals, and they're told there's nothing wrong with them. It's all in the head. And they know it. I mean, they can't think. They have intense headaches. They have symptoms of allergies and autoimmune disease and rash and chronic intestinal diarrhea, things of that sort. And, you know, there is a definite complex of symptoms here Sydney, probably I left out a couple of important things, but these people are incapacitated. And we're talking almost, well, initially, a third of the veterans. And we sent 1 million people over there, and we're talking close to 300,000 of them are incapacitated to this very day. We sent them 695,000 people, and somewhere, well, I think the sum total of the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War that we're engaged in now, Doug Rock uses a figure, I think, 325,000 of them have so far received some sort of a disability rating, and there are another 80,000 claims that are waiting. So this is a major human disaster, totally being covered up by our controlled media. So pick the story up there, Denise.
Okay. Early on, we started watching what they were doing and funding on research. We went into it with three goals here. Number one, if your troops are sick and they cannot work, they cannot maintain their job, they need to be compensated so their families and themselves are not homeless and on the street and trying to maintain families. Our divorce rate went way up there, and sorry to see that it took us a long time to try and finally get the compensation rolling. We had, what we first discovered was we had clinical evaluation programs registry set up. Otherwise, picking up the guinea pigs and studying them. And the DOD had them and the VA had them. Sad to say, that's how the current troops are going to be set up also. Their registries and tracking programs being set up by law now through bills and into law. From there, we had just a ton load of hearings on the Hill that started in 1993, November 1993, and then we have Riegel's hearing and Rockefeller's hearing and reports in 1994. We had hearings with Government Reform Committee, the VA committees on both the House and Senate with a three-reading circuit. Then we had the Presidential Advisory Committee appointed by President Clinton. That was kind of a loaded committee with people that certainly most of us, if we look at people's background, we try to give people a fair shake. Some of these I certainly wouldn't have put on the committee, but we did our best to try to convince them of the information we had and the data we had. It was extended 18 months, I believe, and then we went into a presidential oversight board. At the same time, we had the DOD initiate a special office of Gulf War investigation, the Office of Special Investigation at the DOD level.
But don't you think there was a real effort there to cover up the truth? In other words, other than Senator Riegel, who got to the truth, and it cost him his bid for re-election. They went after him and got him out of the Senate. But haven't most of these investigations really been cover-ups?
I would think so. We try to take it, legitimately. We take it as soldiers, and we come forward with the information we've gathered, and try our best to. And we're having to fight them. We're sick, and we're having to go forward and fight them. We're having to go fight and try to get a bill through. They never do write a bill the exact way we want it. You know, they have their ways to do it, and even though you try to convince them otherwise, you go, "Well, we can't do it your way. It's too many ornaments on that Christmas tree." And you'll have to take what we give you and come back after, you go that route. They were spending money out the kazoo on stress. They were trying to push this off on post-traumatic stress disorder. The Gulf War vets, we've finally proven the point, and I think by 1994 with the Research Advisory Committee under the VA, we finally got a good committee. And we have told them, and we have proven the point, that this is not post-traumatic stress. We have finally grabbed that research money and getting it directed in the right way. We're looking for diagnostics, we're looking for biomarkers, and we're looking for treatment. And the impact will be on the treatment. So we are still pushing because we know that the diagnostic work that was needed was not done. It's still not being done. And so we still, we had compensation, we had diagnostic testing on the table, and we had treatment.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Denise Nichols. And the truth of the matter is, the elite people, the American people, just couldn't take the truth. so they're not going to tell them. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Denise Nichols. We're talking about the origin of the Gulf War Syndrome. Denise, did you ever run into any people that had had a mycoplasm, chronic mycoplasm infection, or been treated for these chronic infections and improved? Did you ever see that?
Yes, I did. And one of the things that I've yelled and screamed about is that we haven't been afforded even the viral testing, a good viral panel, that is not even included. And anybody knows, if you have an immune system that's been put under pressure, you need to keep a watch and look closely at the red blood cells, the white blood cells, all the components of the blood, beyond the neurological damage that's done by these substances.
And of course, there was an increase in the incidence of multiple sclerosis.
They have not been routinely scanning or testing, you know, diagnosing and testing these people for, you know, whole group of things, be it mycoplasma, be it the herpes viruses. These things, what happens is that your immune system keeps a lot of things under control until it comes under attack. And then you have reactivation of viruses. We know you have to treat those things. You have to treat the infections, be it mycoplasma, from wherever it came from, the herpes viruses or any cytomegaloviruses, these things that are reactivated because your immune system is affected. If you do not treat those things, the picture continues to be complicated. The radiation, the inhalation, the shrapnel being left in, we're looking at renal damage, we're looking at respiratory problems, we're looking at cancer. You know, a lot of the organophosphates eventually could possibly cause cancers, but for sure the depleted uranium. It is a complex picture because there was a number of exposures. But Dr. Stan, what I want to mention to you is we were soldiers. We did our job. We came home expecting health care if we needed it, compensation if we needed it. We expected a fair deal. Now, a lot of us are older, and we knew the history of Agent Orange and atomic dust. We were hoping our government had changed. It has not. And what has happened is we got directed through bills and laws to go to the Institute of Medicine, have them kind of play the judge. But yet they were limited to only peer-reviewed journal articles, number one. They could not ask for any studies that had been paid for by the American taxpayer.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Denise Nichols. And Denise, before I go on, do you have a web page, or is there a web page where people can get information on the Gulf War Syndrome and the betrayal of the American soldiers who fought so bravely in the first Gulf War?
You can go to NationalVeterans-Coalition.org. That's www.NationalVeterans-org. NationalVeterans-Coalition.org. Also, they can contact me if they need to at dsnurse@AOL.com.
DSNurse, is that right?
At AOL.com.
Okay, dsnurse@AOL.com. Okay.
Okay. Going back to the IOM.
That's the Institute of Medicine. Go ahead.
Right, the Institute of Medicine. They could not ask the Army or any of the other services or any of the atomic agencies, whoever may have research that they haven't published. And we all know that happens. They do a study, but they don't proceed to publish it. We've even had some of our projects that were funded that haven't been peer-reviewed and published.
What you're basically talking about is the Institute of Medicine study, which was supposed to evaluate the Gulf War Syndrome, and yet they were hamstrung at every turn, so they really couldn't get to the bottom of what was going on.
Correct.
Is that right?
And when we went through this, and we're almost through with the initial studies, and some of them have had updates, November 2005, Congressman Kershaw, very good man, and has stayed on the case with anthrax and Gulf War illness, and on the current truth He is a good man, and he's trying his best with the political situation. We had Mr. Jim Benz testify. He's the chairman of the Research Advisory Committee. And it comes down to not only what I just told you about the Institute of Medicine, how their hands were thrown, but they are ignoring the animal studies that have been done. Dr. Albadani over at Duke University has done some excellent work showing that damage can be done in animals with the combination of exposures. They were ignoring the animal studies. They accepted animal studies with Agent Orange. They won't accept them for us. Since the get-go, Dr. Sim, what I've noticed as a nurse is that those of us that were intelligent, medical people, you know, what have you, when we were pushing, like, give us a heavy metal testing when we first went into the VA, they refused.
And now you did a heavy metal for testing for the depleted uranium.
Hey, just give us a normal heavy metal and see if there's something there. What I'm saying is that the typical things that, if you know what these people were encountering in the gut, these are things you would be looking for that are commonly available at any hospital. Okay, not even a specialized test for the DU. Okay, heavy metal screening. Doing the viral panels. There was a lot of things that were left out. PET scans, SPECT scans, they were battling whether they could admit those and have them show anything of whether they were valid. So every step of the way, the vets had to battle. They are sick.
In fact, I talked to one fellow who worked for the VA, and he actually was a neurologist and a psychiatrist, and he was doing MRIs on the veterans, the Gulf War veterans, and he was finding areas of demyelinization. Now, you can't make this up. You get areas of demyelinization in the brain.
He had good doctors that tried to do the right thing.
But, of course, they got into trouble, didn't they?
Dr. Bill Bonswager, California.
Yeah, right.
I sent vets out to him. I had a vet sitting there that was a Medical Service Corps officer, had served in Vietnam and Gulf War, full colonel, served as an undersecretary under Reagan in the Education Department. And he sat there and witnessed when they ordered Dr. Bonswager not to see any more Gulf War vets.
And that's because he was doing MRIs. He was finding the areas of demyelinization. They didn't want him to find anything.
Dr. Bonswager just doing a good physical assessment, like a person should that's trained.
Right.
Just doing a good physical assessment, you can pinpoint the damage in these troops. They weren't even doing that. They weren't doing good physical assessments or neurological testing. You know, that doesn't cost any money. It costs a little time with your doctoring and testing reflexes and testing take a needle and stick them all over and see if their sensation is different, left to right, upper mobility, you know, things like that. It's being complete when you're examining a person. That is your first weapon as a doctor, is to use good history taken, data collection, physical assessment, then you go to the next level of diagnostic tests. They weren't even allowing them to do good physical assessments. So you think they would let them order heavy metals? Do you think they'd let them check, well, why are they having nosebleeds and gum bleeds? Maybe we ought to look at their coagulation factors in their blood and try to figure this out. You know, this would be what you would normally see in a civilian hospital of a sequence of action. We weren't getting that.
Well, if you don't,
as a nurse, I experienced it firsthand. I saw others going through it. I talked to other vets. I saw the whole sequence as we've gone through. I spent hours up on the hill away from my family out of Denver to go to the hill and fight for our vets' rights and fight for these bills. I knew they weren't perfect, but it was better than nothing. And I was fighting with them all the way, trying to get better things done. And I'd fight to get co-sponsors to get a bill through to help us on compensation. And I would run, it was so funny, Senator Campbell says, a senator from my home state that was concerned. He really was concerned, and he tried to back us up. I got disoriented. Totally disoriented up there, which can happen to the Gulf War vets. You get lost, you get disoriented, confused. you know, your cognitive abilities. And finally, after I passed the door, I guess four or five times, she came out and said, where are you trying to head to? Let me walk you to the next one. And I had my little list out with my schedule, you know, and she walked with me. And I said, listen, if you find me later in the day wandering around, take me down, stick me in a cab, send me, you know, to my hotel, whatever. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is what your troops have to go through, besides what you're seeing on TV, which has happened before with the Operation Desert Storm troops that were kept on, you know, temporary duty assignment until they decide what they're going to do with you, whether they medically retire you, you know, or return you to duty. It was the same type of facilities that we dealt with, these rundown barracks they were putting them in as they were holding them. This is how we treat our wounded. And the Washington Post, you know, reporter reported on that situation. And it's from one thing to the next. We have 30% of the new troops from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom with ill-defined symptoms and conditions again, 30%.
I think that's such an important thing. We've rotated about a million people through there, and a lot of them been come back and been
But we still have some common factors, and that's what I want to point out. We still have promethean in the uniforms coated. We still have the sand factor. We still have the DU being used. We have the vaccines being used. They probably don't have the chemical nerve agent exposure like we had. They haven't been using the protostigmine bromide that I'm aware of. I've been asking, you know, the troops as they come home and different groups to try to find out if they changed some of the things they've done on us. The anthrax vaccine was up in the air, but some of them had already gotten it. So there's some similarities, there's some differences, but here we come again, 30%. We started at a little lower percentage when we started back in 92. 30% with ill-defined conditions. And I'll tell you something else, Dr. Stan. I was working, and I'll take care of my troops, and some of them do have PTSD, and they can have psychological PTSD and a physical problem. I looked up a resource that I read in his book on PTSD, Tom Williams. And up, he served in Vietnam. Very interesting history. He's a psychiatrist now. He had been over to Japan with a non-governmental organization for the earthquake years ago. And so he does still do a lot of active work, helping people deal with traumatic episodes in life. And I tracked him down when he was headed home from Japan. And he happened to live out close to where I live. And he said, come out and meet with me. Bring whatever you have. I'll be home tomorrow. And, I mean, this was when he was coming home from Japan. He must have been exhausted. I took the Regal Report, Rockefeller Report, various things. In the Regal Report, for some reason, I had, you know, the page kind of flipped open all the time to the symptoms list. As I'm going in his house, he goes, these are all radiation symptoms. And I went, who is this guy? What does he know? Ends up his father had died recently at that point. His father had been an atomic death. So it was very interesting to catch him up with what was going on with us in the U.S. group at that time. The knowledge is out there. I mean, you look at the symptoms, and if you know your stuff, you can relate and go, hey, you know, some of this is radiation symptoms, some of it's chemical exposure. And we spend time to delay, deny, distort, lead astray, lead them into a rat maze, while people are sick and they're battling the VA to try to get compensation. They don't. Their families are breaking apart. Many of these troops cannot function on their own. And so these troops were well educated with Operation Desert Storm. I had people that had double degrees. They couldn't hold the job at Burger King. this is what we've done to our troops. In trying to get them help. The government saying it's all stress, you know, whatever. Then you don't get support from, you know, when their families break up and they go back home to their parents. You may have a stepfather that, you know, hey, they believe the government and this guy's just being lazy and they toss them out on the street. They have nowhere to turn. They're not getting answers. They're getting worse. We lose track of them. I mean, I have people that had cardiac problems that went off to, you know, be evaluated for cardiac problems that I never heard from again. This is reality. And I want America to wake up. I want doctors and nurses and people out there. Start yelling for us. We cannot let this go anymore. There's got to be changes. There has to be big changes. One of the sworn duties of the Constitution as written, and of senators and reps, one of the first things that's above a lot of things that we fund in this country, is you take care of your active duty troops. And as I said, you can send us to war. You cannot close the checkbook morally and ethically when we come home and need help. And these troops don't really want a handout. If we could get the answers and get treatment and have a quality of life and try to work, there's very few of them that wouldn't rather be out there, you know, doing what they were doing before. They're brave, they're proud, they're educated, and it's terrible to see them go through this, and it's terrible to see a whole new group of veterans. We had the Gulf War veterans. I think we went quiet at 9/11. And when we knew what was coming at us, we were like the Vietnam vets were when we were headed out. You're sitting there praying, hoping, speaking out and saying, you know, no, don't do this. And then trying your best to testify for them and say, they need to learn the lessons learned. You give a physical with blood work and urine before they go. Hands on, not a questionnaire. And then as soon as they get back, you're taking collections, blood, urine, you know, workup, so that you have it documented. They didn't do it for us, they haven't done it in the past, and they're not doing it again. So how do we stop the cycle, people? That's my question. And that's...
Well, I know you're on the front lines, Denise, and you and a group of people who are now working with... Major Rocky, try to get the information out. Try to get the people to understand that we betrayed the men, the veterans of the first Gulf War, and we're betraying the veterans of the second Gulf War. This is
we
the
have been betraying
thing.
Our troops since day one. That's why I mentioned the atomic vets, the Agent Orange vets, us, and now the current ones. This is why it's imperative that America get educated. We have set up websites. We have shared information. I mean, in the beginning, you didn't have hearing transcripts and all that on C-SPAN. You didn't have them getting it onto their committee website. We were hand-typing some stuff in to share, to educate each other as we went through this, much less posting it on websites so that the information was available. The veterans themselves led the charge on that. We were shaming the government, saying, hey, we got the transcripts out before you ever dreamed. It may not be perfect, but at least we got the content of what was there covered. So it's been a battle. We've talked. We've done interviews around the world. I've been interviewed from Rome, from Greece, from Japan. We have educated the world. The information is out there on websites.
Well, I think, Denise, the thing is that the people throughout much of the rest of the world understand the devastating effect of depleted uranium. It is simply here in America, because of the degree of control of the media, the average American can't believe that we would be intentionally poisoning our own troops.
We've had journalists that have been pulled off the story. We've had people that taped this. They said they're fighting for us. I believe them. They've been taken off the story. It gets down to they'd rather fund whatever they want to fund, be it a new warship, a new plane, instead of, you know, for the cost of one plane, we used to say we could save so many veterans, or we could make a change. It's a budgetary problem, not only admitting it for troops, and I mean, figure it out. It's $1 trillion when you talk about compensation and for a lifetime or health care to go along with it. So it is a delay and denial because of budgetary, not only for us, and having to clean up those environments, just like we had to clean up the arsenal out here north of Denver. The cleanup costs and what we're giving Vietnam some money to pay up some of the worst, clean up some of the worst areas of the Agent Orange that they were left with to live with. And, you know, so Agent Orange, you know, you pick up those articles and go, yeah, there's a bill up in the House right now.
Hold that thought, Denise. Well, Denise, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
There's money in a bill right now to be given to Iraq to clean up the DU. They've already done it for Kuwait. It is time, America, the information's out there and the vets are turning to you more and more to help us to change this system, to stand up for us. We're your sons and daughters, sisters and brothers, mothers and fathers, to your next door neighbor.
But of course, do you think that bill is really going to get through? Won't there be tremendous opposition to it?
The DU cleanup bill?
Right.
When the Democrats are in control, I'm sure that there will be money given to them.
All right. Well,
I hope you're
right.
It may not be talked about in the press, but it's there. You have to go and check your bills as they work their way through Congress. You have to be inquisitive, America. A lot of this doesn't poke up to the media until somebody goes running to them and jumps up and down and goes, you should cover this.
But, I mean, can you really clean up a whole nation that you've contaminated with depleted uranium?
It's going to be a lot of money, isn't it? I mean, when you look at what we've done cleaning up and getting rid of chemical weapons we had, and the cleanup costs when we close down facilities, that's a lot of money.
And of course, what are we going to do with all the Iraqi civilians that are contaminated? And all the Iraqi children have been born with birth defects because of the depleted uranium contamination. And the human tragedy, not only within the American troops, but within the Iraqi people.
That's correct. And our soldiers that had birth defect children that tried to take their case to court, it ended up that they extended the Ferris Doctrine, which says the servicemen can't sue, and even your contractors have contract coverage that you can't sue them. And they extended it to the family members, to the babies, that we couldn't even sue for the damages done to those babies because their fathers went and served and they got defects. Our soldiers are treated as second class.
Well, what do you expect when...
It's terrible to hear the debate on TV to support your troops when you know the full history of what's going on.
Well, you know how Henry Kissinger and
you
President Kennedy...
You almost gag and throw up every time they do this because it's a political... It's political.
Okay,
you
know, Denise...
Politics and science in bed are making strange that... and creating havoc.
Well, we're out of time, Denise, but thank you so much, very much. And I know how deeply you feel about what the betrayal of our fighting men. Good night. And God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and Denise feels very deeply about what's going on, and so do I. And that's why I hope many of you want to get the material we carry. We have the Rockefeller Committee report, a report put out by the Veterans Administration over the senator, a signature of Jay Rockefeller, and it will tell you much of what Denise said tonight. We do not carry the Regal report, although if you want to get it, it's about 1,000 pages, and we can get that for you through Joyce Riley. And then we have a four-tape set on the Gulf War illness. We have a four-tape set on vaccine A. And we have a four-tape set on the chronic fatigue, which is really what this is all about. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the anthrax vaccine. So we have the anthrax vaccine, the chronic fatigue syndrome, vaccine A, and on the Gulf War illness. We carry an amazing book. It's called Against All Enemies. It's written by Seymour Hersh, a short little book. But as he talks about the Gulf War illness and the betrayal of our troops, and we have the last supply of these anywhere in the world, I think it's only, well, it's an inexpensive book. Against All Enemies by one of the finest writers we have today, Seymour Hersh. If you want to really see what this is about, we have a DVD that Joyce Riley put out. It's called Beyond Treason. That's Beyond Treason. And when you get a DVD, you actually get a CD that has recorded there literally thousands of pages of government documents pointing out that they know how toxic the depleted uranium is. They just don't want anybody else to know. These are all, many of them are restricted government documents, the manuals about depleted uranium. They understand what they're doing. They're killing our boys. And then, of course, we have the book Project Daily. Project Daily is written by Dr. Garth Nicholson, one of the most eminent physicians in America, scientists in America. He was professor, had two professorships at MD Anderson Clinic, until he began looking into the Gulf War syndrome, until he began looking into the experiments that were carried out at Huntsville in Texas, at the prison there, where they were experimenting with these new types of mycoplasm that were genetically engineered to create chronic disability and progressive neurological disease. And a number of the physicians who had been Dr. Nicholson's students and his superior were all murdered or died under very mysterious circumstances. And Dr. Nicholson had to actually flee from Texas for his life and to save his life and his wife's life. His book, Project Daily, is one of the most gripping stories you'll ever read. It's based upon his life. It's written as fiction, but based upon fact. I know because I've interviewed many of the people in the book, and it reads like a Tom Clancy story. The only trouble is real. It goes into the background of how they created the AIDS epidemic and all sorts of new diseases, how they created this genetically engineered mycoplasm and used it on the American people and the American servicemen as guinea pigs. Project Daily is must reading for anybody who really wants to understand what's going on. And we do carry the book of Vaccine A, going into the experiments that were used, the experimental vaccines used in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. We have both the book, and we only have two copies of the book. And then, of course, we also have the four-tape set, my interviews with the author of the book. Information you need to know to understand the total indifference to human suffering of certain people who are working at the highest levels of our government. How do we understand that? Well, you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You get our material on planned population reduction. That's planned population reduction. You can get the complete House Appropriations Committee testimony by Dr. Donald MacArthur back in 1969, where he tells about how they're going to create new diseases to be used for mass killing and chronic disability. Of course, Zygmunt Brzezinski talked about in 1970 in his book Between Two Ages how one day we'd be able to create chronic diseases to disable the enemy. Who is the enemy? Why, the American people. If you'd like the page from his book, we have it. Between Two Ages by Zygmunt Brzezinski, our number 1-800-544-8927.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.